This is the second of a two-part interview with Mark Speck and his research into the World Football League. The first part of the interview was featured in episode 228.
It's go time.
In 1974, the one season that they did finish, the playoff format kind of got a little bit funny.
Oh, my goodness. It changed more than the weather. Originally, it was going to be the three division winners and a wild card team. And then they were going to play the World Bowl. They were going to play semi-final games. Then the two teams were going to play the World Bowl. In the middle of the season, there was teams that were starting to get better. Hawaiians, Portland, they were terrible in the first half of the season. Now they got this NFL talent. A lot of guys had gotten cut by the NFL, and they were getting a lot better as far as their overall. The teams were playing better, and they said, well, geez, these teams are playing better. So they went to where it was like the teams with the best second half of the season record. It was like eight teams, and it was six teams. Then it was they said, let's just name Memphis the champions because they had the best record, and let's have Memphis play Birmingham and Florida, and they didn't even put Southern California, who had won the Western Division, in. It was just crazy. And they went right up to the last couple of days before the postseason started, you know, so the games did terribly because nobody knew who was going to play who. The teams were no better because they didn't know what opponent they were going to have. I think the Blazers went from the Charlotte to Birmingham to, let's see, it would have been Philadelphia. It was like three times in like 3 days their opponents changed. So they're watching film on this team. Then the next game, no, you're going to play this team, so we're going to watch film on this and practice for this team. Oh, wait a minute. No, you're playing this team. So it was just crazy. I mean, it didn't help them at all because it looked silly. It looked ridiculous for these teams to be changing opponents on a daily basis. You know, they had to change the site of the World Bowl because it was going to be in Jacksonville, where they had a team that folded and left the league. Then they were going to try Honolulu, but they hadn't built the Aloha Stadium yet. It wasn't finished. So they just wound up playing whoever had the best record in the World Bowl. They were going to host it, and that turned out to be Birmingham. I think I wrote an article about it and submitted it to the PFRA yet. It was just one of the things that I have in the book that is just, I go through the details, and it was just insane how they did that, how they changed it over the last few weeks of the season. And then they wonder why the games didn't do very well.
Ironically, the Blazers, who were supposed to play in Charlotte, but because of poor ticket sales, the Hornets were kicked out of the playoffs. The Blazers actually make it all the way to the championship game.
Yeah, they did. They beat Philadelphia. Didn't have too much trouble doing that. King Corcoran there for the Bell had a bad game. And the Blazers defense was good. They were playing down in Orlando. They were a team that was really special. They really were. It was a team that hung together. They didn't get paid for the last 13 weeks of the season. Jack Pardee is bringing toilet paper in and soap into the locker room. He went to a drugstore or something to buy some groceries or something and handed the guy a $20 bill, and the guy's looking at it like it's counterfeit. His wife wrote a check in another store for some groceries. She went home. The manager of the store followed her and took the groceries back, saying that the check was probably no good because it was the Blazers. It's just a lot of stuff happened to that team. It was just amazing. It was just a laundry list. And I always wanted to do a book about them, and I'm glad I did. They had nobody come into the games, especially toward the end of the season. They switched a Charlotte game and a Birmingham game from Orlando to those cities because they were thinking they were going to get some better attendance, a better cut of the gate. And they offered them, you know, so much money to change the venue. Didn't get the money after all. Or not as much as they hoped to. It was just a season that could have been lost, but Pardee was one of these coaches that just said, hey, look, let's just play for ourselves. Let's play for our pride. If you want to leave, go ahead. A couple of players did, but most of them hung in there, and they beat Philadelphia. Then they beat Memphis, last second touchdown, and Lewis Ross blocked the last second field goal attempt that would have tied the game. And then they went into the Birmingham, fell behind 22-0, scored three touchdowns in the last quarter and almost pulled it out, but they lost 22-21. It was just an amazing season. And like I said, a lot of stuff went wrong. A lot of guys suffered. Mike McBath, defensive tackle. I talked to him on the phone once, and he was telling me it was just disheartening to stand on the sidelines and look out in the parking lot and see your car get repossessed while the game was going on. You know, they're out there repossessing their cars. You know, guys couldn't pay their electric bill. They couldn't pay for groceries, get their cars fixed. It was just really something. I mean, there was other teams that, you know, had those kind of problems. They certainly weren't unique, the Blazers, in that respect. It was just the idea that they succeeded so well, despite all the problems that they faced every week on a daily basis. Were they going to move to Tampa? Were they going to move to Dallas? Were they going to move to Atlanta? They had all these cities that they were going to move to. Before the Philadelphia game, playoff game, this guy shows up. He's going to pump $4 million into the franchise, displays a check for $1.5 million at halftime of the game. They had a big press conference, and it turns out it was all a scam. From what the consensus was that the league kept hushed about it, tried to, well, are you going to get this money? Play this next game against Memphis. You'll get the money. And they still didn't get the money, and they didn't get the money until, I don't know if any of them got any money. Some of the players I talked to, they said, no, we didn't get a cent. Sometimes you see it's $100 after the World Bowl, $150, that kind of thing. They got basically airfare back to Orlando from Birmingham. It was just an amazing story to me that, like I said, some of the other teams went through it. They didn't succeed quite as well as the Florida Blazers did. But, you know, and not to minimize or diminish their stories, because they certainly had a lot of problems on a daily basis. You know, that's why I wrote the book about the Detroit Wheels. They were another team that was just awful. Yeah, the Blazers were an amazing team. I was really taken with that story I read about back in the day. And I said, I'm going to write a book about that. Fortunately, like I said, my publisher was all for it and said, hey, this is great. Do it. And it's you know, done well. Some good reviews. I met a lot of good players. Talked to them on the phone, interviewed them. Great guys. Remembered that time. And I try to honor them. I never criticize the players on any team. It was all the owners. It was all the people that, you know, were running the league that were doing that. Those guys deserved the criticism. But the players were playing, as I think it was John Matlock from Birmingham said, you know, it's a tough game to play for free. It really is. And none of the players, like I said, any of the players that went through these hardships and went through these bad times just to play a game they love. And it was both seasons that happened, 74 and 75. And it was just a great story. It was one of the best stories I've ever read about in sports. It was just amazing that they hung together and continued to win games.
Birmingham, of course, wins the championship 22-21. There's a controversial play in the game where I think it's Tommy Riemann who is thought to have fumbled the ball outside the goal line and goes through for a touchback, but replays show that he actually had scored. That would have helped Florida.
Right.
At the end of the game, to sort of as part of ignominy, weren't the Americans' jerseys taken from them as a way to satisfy team debt?
Oh, yes, they did. Yes, they did. They were that Riemann play, Billy Hobbs, the linebacker, was one guy who just couldn't stop talking about it, even after the game. This officiating is terrible. The replays did show he had scored. He had crossed the plane of the goal line. The ball came out. Matt Meslowski, a wide receiver, almost got it. He had it just within his grasp, and then a Birmingham player kicked it out of the end zone. That would have been a big thing because they had a great drive that opening drive there. They went right down the field all on the ground. And who knows what could have happened. That would have really helped them at the end of the game. But, yeah, the Birmingham players go into the locker room. There's deputies there ready to take their uniforms. Guys are going over the windows, sneaking their helmets and stuff out through the windows to their family members outside to try to salvage them. Some guys got that. The only thing they could keep was their shoes because they bought their own cleats. But everything else was fair game for the sheriff deputies to like you said, use to pay off debts. That happened with a lot of teams, even the Blazers. They had a yard sale there at the Orange County Courthouse, sold all a bunch of their stuff that they'd paid $70,000 for, and it wound up one guy bought it for $3,000. Bought everything up, and he probably resold it and made money. That happened to Birmingham.
We haven't even talked about Honolulu and the Hawaiians. how were they added to this mix, and how would you even construct a schedule to get them involved?
Well, that's the thing. I know they had it was a sincere effort on their part to get a team into Hawaii. They had only had, I think, a minor league team before that, football team, pro football team. They had the college, the Rainbows, and the minor league baseball team. They got in their minds to put a team there. It's tough because it's what is it? It's like 6 hours behind New York. So if you want to schedule a game for, say, to air at 1 o'clock in the afternoon in New York, it's got to have to play in Hawaii early morning. And plus the fact that the Hawaiians said weekday football is not going to go here in Hawaii. We're going to play on Sundays. Everybody else can play when they want. We're playing on Sundays. They were adamant about that. They were playing on Sundays. And say the first team that went over there was Detroit. They played on Wednesday night or Thursday, had to fly all the way to Hawaii and play on Sunday. And that happened for like the first half of the season until they finally said, you know, like, you guys have got to move with the rest of us. And they finally did, because they realized that Sunday football wasn't going to draw any more attendance than weekday football. So they moved with the rest of the crowd and finally changed all their games to Wednesday or Thursday, depending on whether they're going to be televised. It was tough because of the time change. Detroit, that was the one game they didn't broadcast on the radio in Detroit, because the game would have started at like 1 a.m. for Detroit time. You know, they said, no, we're not going to do that. You know, and then Hawaii, when they first started out, a lot of the officials, the executives in the front office were guys from the mainland, as they like to say. I remember that word from Hawaii 5-0 back in the day, the old show. They made a lot of not very good decisions, including the Sunday football, but they also made a decision that they were going to broadcast the games on tape delay in Hawaii that same day. If they played at, say, 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon Hawaii, then at 7 o'clock they were going to play it on the TV. So it's like, why go to the game? Maybe have a rain, sit in the rain or whatever, the heat or whatever it was, just sit at home and watch the games on TV. So that was not a smart move. And plus the fact, Aloha Stadium, they were hoping to start that playing there in 74, but there was construction delays. There was all kind of things going on. Workers were getting injured. They thought it was cursed. They had to bring like a shaman in to like say a prayer for it. It was all kind of delays. They wound up not playing in there until September of 75. So they had to play in Honolulu Stadium, which was known as the Termite Palace. It was an old wooden stadium, not very big. And so they had to play the 74 season there and part of the 75. I think they were sincere. They had Chris Hemeter was one of the owners, Sam Battistone. They had some money men involved. It wasn't like they weren't financially sound as far as the owners, but I think they figured out that in order to fill Aloha Stadium, one out of every 14 people in the islands has to be there. So they just didn't have the population. You know, it just wasn't populated enough to actually support a team with enough of an attendance to make it a go. It was interesting. They played there. They signed a lot of guys to future contracts, and a lot of the guys played there because they'd much rather play in Hawaii in the wintertime than New York or Philadelphia or someplace like that. So they wound up having most of their players that they signed, they got cut or released by the NFL or played in 75 like Calvin Hill. And they went.
Now, you mentioned Hemeter, and Chris Hemeter, he does become, after Gary Davidson, in charge of the league.
It was kind of there's still some conjecture about how Davidson left the league. He says he resigned. Some of the owners, like Tom O'Riger in Chicago, said they kicked him out. They had enough of him. Tom O'Riger was a good owner for Chicago. You know, didn't spend a lot of money on talent, but he had a lot of money. And what got him, he was very excited about the league when it started out. But when teams started to fail, he didn't like the fact that he had to not only pay his payroll, he had to support these other teams like Detroit, Jacksonville, and give them money to other teams that were financially failing. So he says, I don't want to pay for somebody else's mistakes. So he was one of the guys that led the league, bloodless coup, you might want to say, about getting rid of Gary Davidson there in October of 74. And he did leave. So Hemeter came in. He didn't want to be the commissioner. He wanted to be called the president. So he called himself the president. Had the Hemeter plan, which percentage of the gate, as far as the salaries were based on attendance. They got a flat fee of 500. If this attendance was so much, then they got a little bit more. Some of the players liked it. Some of them didn't. It was a good plan. And people say that if he would have been there as maybe the commissioner at the start, maybe they'd have done a little bit better. He had money. He had some good ideas. Would have been a success. Who knows? Couldn't have been any worse. Let's put it that way. But, you know, Hawaii did well as far as their payroll, I think, then until the 75 season. And I think things around the league was going down. Yeah, Hemeter spent the whole spring of 75 on airplanes, just going around all these league cities, making sure that everybody was getting financially stable. And he was really a big advocate for the league. And so I think that would have been a better choice, you know, that at the start, if Davidson had said, hey, let's put Hemeter in here. If they couldn't find like an Upton Bell would have been a good choice to start out as commissioner, or Burt Bell Jr., his brother, or a couple of names that came up were Don Klosterman from the Rams and Al Davis of all names. If anybody could have gotten the WFL over the hump, it would have been Al Davis. He would have been in there fighting tooth and nail. But yeah, Davidson was out. I think he started World Team Tennis and some kind of bowling league after that. Not everything he did was negative. You know, he helped with salaries. He was one of Sports Illustrated came out with their top influential people of in sports. He was one of them. I think sometimes he gets a bad rap, and deservedly so in some aspects. I mean, like I said, no vetting of owners, you know, not a really good idea to start as quick as he did, but he did some good things. He had some good ideas. You know, like I said, he made a good salesman, a good promoter, but as an administrator, he wasn't very good. And like he himself admitted, tried a lot of the things that we did in the WHA that worked there, but just did not work in the WFL. He admitted he made some mistakes. He was out. Hemeter took over. And like I said, Hemeter was, he had a good business mind, you know, had a good company that he was involved with.
And sadly for the WFL, it's prior to week 13 of 1975. I think it's October the 22nd, a Wednesday or something like that. They announced that's it. We're done.
Yeah.
They're so cash strapped. And I think the speculation was at the time they needed at least $40 million just to get through this season and the one that they had planned for the next. There was just no point going further. The money wasn't there.
They had met a week before. That would have been week 11. They met I think it was the 12th. And they got together. You know, all the scuttlebutt was going around. What's going to happen? What's going to happen to the league? They decided to keep going. They didn't drop any teams. They were talking about dropping Portland and Philadelphia because they were so bad as far as attendance. San Antonio was really hurting. They were talking about dropping some teams. They were talking about folding. But they said, no, let's go ahead and keep going and keep trying. That next week, again, was terrible. Not many people in the stands. And they just finally met again and said, you know, they voted, and I think it was 6-4 to vote to say, now let's just throw in a towel. We've had enough. Yeah, I think that somebody said that it would have taken, I don't know how many years, it's like 12 years just to pay off all the debts before they would have broke even if they'd have kept playing. So it was just crazy. It was just, you know, they just had so much money they lost. I think it was, they found out it was like $30 million in a year and a half, which I think is like something like 150 some million nowadays in today's money in just a year and a half. Four teams still wanted to keep playing. Amazingly, like you said, the 22nd, that's when they, you know, announced they were going to fold again, just not, you know, just a year and a half into it.
And for those interested, the Birmingham Vulcans win the championship because they had the best record, 9-3 that year.
Some people say that. I don't know. I know that they declared them the champions because they did. They had the best record. I'm not sure if that's official or not. They did that themselves. I don't know if they ever got rings or anything, but they had the best attendance. They played a scrimmage game against Memphis that drew 35,000 people. Nobody else could draw that. And like I said, I think Birmingham really took to them, even if they were in the Americans and when they were the Vulcans. The teams, like we had talked about earlier, the teams that didn't have any competition from the NFL seemed to do better. some of them did anyway. Memphis and Birmingham were probably the two best ones. But yeah, it was, yeah, it would have taken a bucket load of money to salvage that, to keep going. So I think they did the prudent thing and the smart thing and just said, okay, that's it. We've had it. We tried, didn't make it. Yeah, it was interesting. And it's an interesting story, that's for sure.
And not all the legacy from the WFL experiment is bad. They did do a couple of innovative things on the field. Explain to me what the action point was.
Well, the action point was a guy named William Finneran came up with it, and they didn't want to have the kickers. They were tired of kickers had taken over football in the NFL. Like 7 or 8 of the top 10 top scorers of in the league were kickers. So they had pretty much the field goal had become too prevalent. So the WFL didn't want that. Finneran came up with this, all these facts and figures about where to put the ball, how to do it. He came up with the best place to score from would have been a 2.5 yard line. So it was going to be scored by either running or passing. You couldn't kick. I think it was one of their better ideas. I wasn't crazy about the 7-point touchdown. I think they should have kept that 6, but you know, you're going for innovation. You're going for something different. And it wasn't 1 point. Action point was 1 point. That was one of their better ideas. And then I think that was probably something that, you know, the NFL didn't, I don't think it was years after that, I think they finally thought they were going to do it. The same guy that did the action point then came up with the colored coded pants in 75, which like different positions would wear different color pants, purple, white, green, and teams refused to wear them. Memphis said, no, we're not wearing these things. And they were supposed, I think one game they played, it was Southern California at Philadelphia, and they wore them. It did look silly. It was not, you know, they wore the same jersey, you know, the regular team jerseys, but they wore these different colored pants. Vince Papale said it looked like the gardens at the Vatican. When you're watching players, you're trying to defend against the pass, you're looking at their pants and you're looking at the colored pants. Like if some team had a white pants on and maybe the other team had red pants on, you're looking for that, you know, that color. And to have all these different colors was just too confusing. They scrapped the idea in the preseason. Like I said, I think they only wore them in one game. They also had the idea of having field goals being different lengths, being different points. Anything within a 10-yard line was 1, 10 to the 19 was 2, and then after that it was 3. That didn't work out because it just was confusing. And in my opinion, they probably, you know, if somebody was at the 18-yard line and, yeah, they'd take a deliberate penalty, move the ball back, and then instead of a 2-point field goal, kick a 3-point field goal. And the defense would do the same thing. If you're at the 11-yard line, well, you know, jump off sides, okay, move the ball inside of 10, and it's going to be a 1-point instead of a 2. They tried it. A couple of field goals in the preseason there in 75 were kicked that were 2 points. I don't know if they had a 1-pointer or not. Again, some of the good ideas, you know, action point was a good idea. The football, having the Palomino gold with the orange stripes. I've got one. That was a good idea. Some of the new ones, they moved the goalpost to the back of the end zone. 1 foot in bounds when catching a pass. So it added a little excitement to the game. You know, I think that helped a lot. Draw some attention to it and draw some attention to the league, draw some attention to the players. And then the NFL adopted almost all of the same rules at the same time after the WFL had. So the NFL did the same thing. So, you know, oh no, we were thinking about those for years. No, they did it because the WFL did it. And they moved the goalpost back and everything. So, and all a lot of different rules changes, except the 1 foot in bounds. They didn't add that one or the action point. But, you know, they had a lot of things that went right in the WFL. And black ownership, NFL still doesn't have any. They had a Willie Wood, first black head coach since the 20s when Fritz Pollard was in, the first black head coach in pro football. And then he became the first black head coach in the CFL in 1980 when he took over Toronto. You had women in the front office, a lot more black quarterbacks. You had more black assistant coaches. And you can laugh at the league. They had a lot of things that they didn't do right, but a lot of things they did right. And they brought football into some markets that weren't previously looked into: Memphis, Birmingham, Charlotte, Jacksonville. The only one I think that doesn't have a team now is Birmingham. But, you know, Jacksonville has got an NFL team. Carolina's have an NFL team. And Memphis, you know, I mean, Hawaii still doesn't. Portland doesn't. They're never going to, I don't think. I think that was a mistake. They were a big soccer city. Yeah, I think they had a lot of innovations, a lot of aspects about the league that were really positive. I think that get swept under the rug a lot of times instead of being talked about. And I talk about them a lot in my books, you know, about the things that they did that were good ideas that and things that they did that were positive as far as, you know, ownership and black ownership and females with a stronger role. Yeah, I think that kind of stuff should not be forgotten about the league. There were some positives, and I think that should also be chronicled and should also be remembered.
And there were some people that actually got their start or made their name with the WFL. You already talked about Jack Pardee, but Lindy Infante, Marty Schottenheimer, Jim Fossil, John McVay.
Yeah, no, they all went on to coach. Schottenheimer went back to play one more season, got hurt, coached the linebackers for Portland, and he wound up being one of the best head coaches, you know, in the NFL, you know, with all these different teams. He won everywhere he went. And, you know, Lindy Infante, you mentioned him. Pardee was very good at with several teams and several leagues. He was in the USFL. Alfred Jenkins, wide receiver for Birmingham, spent a day in the Houston Oilers training camp in 73. And he went on to be an all-pro with the Atlanta Falcons. Danny White was great with the Cowboys for many years. Coaches, you look at the players that got their start in the WFL that, you know, went on to a lot of success. They're mentioned in my books because they contributed to the history of pro football. Tom Moore, who was a assistant coach for the Stars and the Hornets, helped the Colts, I think, win the Super Bowl there in the 90s or in the 2000s there when he was coaching Peyton Manning. Still a great offensive coach. So you had all these guys that got their start in the WFL, and it was a springboard to success in the NFL and the CFL.
We've only touched on the story of the WFL, but the one thing that you have done, and we talked to it at the beginning of the show, the books that you have written. Can you enumerate the books that you've written and let us know where they can be found?
Well, all of my books are on Amazon, Amazon.com, or you can go through the publisher St. Johann Press. And if you do go through them, and if you mention WFL websites, they will drop the shipping charge. But Amazon is probably the best place to get them. They're available there. The encyclopedia for now, until we get the new one out, that's the best place to get them, or through the publisher. Please do. They sell fairly well, make brisk sales, get good reviews, which I'm happy about, not only for me, but for the players, for the people who are involved in the league, that their story is getting out there and people are learning about it now, years later, and finding out about the league, that it doesn't get forgotten, that it doesn't get lost in the shuffle of football history. I've got my friend Richie Franklin, who runs the WFL project now. I think we started up last August. It's a great site on Facebook. It's a group. Richie is a great advocate for the WFL. He started this whole thing because of the fact that he went to Canton and saw that they had gotten their other leagues display out of Canton, out of the Hall of Fame, was upset about it, tried to get a hold of them. Why aren't you doing this? Didn't get much response. So he's organized team reunions. He's been there with different teams, and he's gotten this WFL project, which is doing great. We've got cheerleaders, we've got former players, executives, we've got collectors, we've got memorabilia guys, we've got guys that know stats, game accounts. I contribute some of my transactions and stuff that I've got. We're trying to honor some of the players who have passed. That's really been a big thing, and we've gotten a lot of members, and it's really going well for us. Amazon.com or the St. Johann Press, where to get my books. I'm just trying to honor the league, honor the players, and have them be remembered even years later.
That's a very noble cause.
Well, things like that shouldn't be swept under the rug just because it isn't the NFL. I feel the same way about the CFL. I think that they have a very illustrious history, a lot of great players. I love the game. I'm a fan of the CFL. I watch the games. They're exciting. I think they're a lot more exciting than the NFL games. You've got all these different rules that make it more exciting. You've got good players. I think that leagues like the CFL, like the WFL, the USFL, any of these other leagues they call, shouldn't be forgotten. I like to honor them, players, anybody that was involved in it, because a lot of them have good memories. A lot of them love to talk about it. I've gotten more information from some of the guys that have posted on there, some of the former players. He was a great guy, and I remember this play when he did this. You hear all these reminiscences, and it's great to hear them talk about it, to remember that kind of thing. For the most part, I'm sure some of them, you know, are probably still waiting for their money. I'm sure they're not exactly completely happy about it. They pass along their good stories about it, and I think that's a great thing.
Are you on the socials, and where do people find you if you are?
I'm on Facebook. I've got a Blazers page group that I have. I have my own, and I have my wife started a page about my books, about the author side of it. My page is just me, but that she's got, you know, anytime any announcements come out about football, any of my books coming out, she will post those on there, you know, when they come out, where you can get them, that kind of thing. And I have, like I said, a Blazers page where I post same kind of stuff, honoring some of the players. WFL Project, I'm in that. Also have a page about the Central Pennsylvania Whitetail Bucks, which is the semi-pro team that played in Central PA when I was a kid in the 70s. And I have a group about them. Great bunch of guys there too. So, you know, I'm on Instagram, but that's more of a personal one. So the Facebook, I've got a couple of things that I'm involved in that I think is are very worthwhile endeavors and very worthwhile for history and for contributions to the game. They shouldn't be forgotten. They should be still recognized and in some cases honored. And some of those players and coaches, like you mentioned, Lindy Infante, they were great coaches in the NFL. Say, well, you know, but they got their start in the WFL, where they got their career started. I think it's a great story, and I'm glad to see that so many people are interested, and people like you, Don, to have me on here and talking about it. I appreciate it. We've gotten a lot of members in the WFL project. I've got a lot of people in the Blazers one. There's people out there that are interested in it. I'm glad to see that. I'm glad to see that they're, you know, I remember when I was a kid, when I was a teenager, watching those games and collect stuff and helmets, jerseys. It's just an amazing group of people. And I love to see it. Warms my heart because of the fact that back in 88, when I started doing this, I said, nobody's doing this. There's nobody out there crazy enough to be researching a league from like 13, 14 years before and going over this stuff. And then I get into PFRA, find Todd Mayer, find out there are other people in there that are just as interested in I am, if not more. And that's a great thing to network that and do that. So that's helped me along the way and helped me with not only my writing, but just being able to talk about it and have groups about it that can talk about the different things that happened. It was a fun league, had a lot of personalities, a lot of things went wrong, but there was a lot of things right about it. Again, should be remembered. And there was a lot of innovations they did that are in football. Yeah, I think it's a wonderful thing. Glommed onto it there in the 80s. And I just started researching it. And when I did, I heard all these great stories. I said, I got to write them. And I haven't stopped since. And, you know, and like I said, I still find stuff today. I mean, I got a guy that is in Winnipeg, a friend of mine. He's got a list of like 2,000 names of players who were cut by the WFL. And he researches these guys, goes into when they played, where they played, who they played for. And it's an amazing thing. We kind of network and exchange information. Well, stuff like that is just amazing. I just think it's a wonderful thing that 50 years later, and this is 50 years this year, still being talked about. It's an amazing story. Amazing story. And again, Don, I appreciate you having me on here. I love talking about it, as you can tell. I do appreciate it. And I think that, again, this is another venue for people to find out about it. These the podcasts are great. I've done numerous podcasts over the years. I think it's another great outlet to get people to listen because it's a new thing. It's technology at its finest that you can do something like this. Whereas before, you could write a book, fine, but now you can talk to people, talk to somebody who has the same interests And I think that's a great thing, too. So, I appreciate you having me on.
Well, Mark Speck, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing this wealth of knowledge that you have about a very interesting and very short-lived WFL.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me again. I appreciate it. If you ever want to talk again, I'd be more than happy to come on your show again. I appreciate it, Don. Thank you very much.
For listening to our show. Third Down Gamble is hosted on Podbean and can be found on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Follow us on Twitter at Third Down Gamble. Join us again at the Third Down Gamble podcast, audio worth watching.
Third Down Gamble uses the expert resources provided by Canadian Football League player and game statistics, for analytics, game notes, and statistics, and 3downnation.com for news, insight, and in-depth analysis. Please visit cfl.ca and 3downnation.com for the most up-to-date information on the Canadian Football League.